When did you start doing Planet of the Apes?
Planet of the Apes was a coloring job that I got through Ty Templeton, who's a Toronto comics maven who's got a finger in many pies and works for Marvel and DC periodically, also for The Simpsons comics, I believe he writes for them, and is a multi-talented fella, musician as well, and he was helping MR Comics, Metal Rose Comics, sort of relaunch using his connections and the people that he knows. He was going to help them to put out a book that was as slick as possible. They were angling for the license for the Family Guy to make a comic of that, and they were promised that they were going to get the license, but then Seth MacFarlane refused at the last moment, and so the people who had promised them the license opened up the catalog to them and said, look, we're sorry about this. Anybody else here that you want, you can, you know, have this license. And they said, oh, the Planet of the Apes license? We'll take that. Todd Templeton's a huge fan of the series. And him and Joe O'Brien got together and plotted out the series and did a great job. It was a lot of fun to work on. It was drawn by Max Douglas, a.k.a. Salgood Sam, who's a really good young Canadian cartoonist. And Tom Fowler did several issues, too. He's another Canadian fella.
When I first saw that was coming out, it was kind of disappointing, because it's like, okay, here's another Canadian comic book company, but they're picking a franchise that is not even remotely hot anymore, and it didn't last that long, did it?
The Planet of the Apes must be a guy thing, but there are a lot of fervent fans, and I believe that we touched their hearts.
I'm glad. Well, I'm not disparaging your work. I was just like, you want these companies to succeed.
That's right, and we especially have tender feelings for MR Comics, because being such a babe in the woods, you know, the Canadian comic book publishing landscape is particularly barren. We have Drawn In Quarterly, of course, something to be very proud of, out of Montreal.
Vancouver has Arcana.
Vancouver.
Which actually has managed to stay afloat. I mean, they have some good comics, but there's a lot of stuff they do that I don't like. But they're doing it, and I'm really happy for them.
There you go. The more, the better. We need to encourage and support these institutions. So, you know, I was working for MR Comics for nothing. But they didn't seem to grow. Like, they released the Planet of the Apes stuff, but then didn't really support it. So, in the end, I've decided to stop working with them, because their projects seem to be sort of left high and dry on the beach, as far as, like, there's no follow-through. But I have hopes for other Canadian companies, and perhaps even becoming an entity like that myself.
Now, you also worked for Speakeasy briefly?
Terrible experience.
Speaking of other fledgling comic book companies.
Yeah, well, this is an example of a bad Canadian company. My God, it was run very, from what I understand, from the research that I did, you know, sort of very top-heavy, in that it was sort of big business instead of starting with any sort of humility. And things came to a head very quickly financially, and there's no real information being passed around. Everything is just posing and excuses and acting and blame shifting, and it was terrible. I ended up working for a month and not being paid for it. So I owe them a big.
Okay. Well, it's good to know, you know, like, there's so much variety in the comic book industry, and you've had such a history with it. It's interesting.
It's really, really, you really learn to appreciate who are competent and who are the clowns. And when you start to hear the circus music, you know to just drop everything and run. It doesn't matter if you've already invested time. You just have to, you hear those clown shoes flapping there, you gotta go the other way, because otherwise it's just not worth it. It's your sanity. And so many people just try and control the process, and they don't want to do the work themselves, but they want to direct it. They want to stick their finger in. And it just becomes so unfair that it makes it impossible to continue to work really hard, you know. So you really have to take care to not put yourself in a position where you don't feel right.
Well, it's a good defense for doing your own stuff.
Yes. Always the best idea is to write and draw your own work. Then you design what you can handle, you know what you like, you know, trying to work with somebody. That's a very big challenge. There could be rewards there too, and it deserves, that ability should be trained, but still, for a fast, easy project, nothing beats doing it solo.
When did you start working for DC Cartoons? Like the actual comic book versions of the cartoons?
Bronwyn Taggart was, I guess, a very perceptive and progressive editor at DC who got in touch with me and asked me, directed by Mark Chiarello, who, you know, apparently just said, oh, kids comics, he'd be perfect for this, you know, like, Mark Chiarello, he was their color editor, their overall line color editor. I like his artwork.
Mm-hmm, I do too. I have some of his solo stuff.
Yeah, he does covers for, he like seems to like the crime comic thing, and very bold graphic work. So very good. And he also colors a lot of Mike Mignola artwork. Mm-hmm. And I remember speaking with him on the telephone, and me insulting him somehow, because, you know, I'm just like saying, oh yeah, well, you get to work on Mike Mignola, that stuff's so well designed. Oh yeah, so well designed, even an idiot could do it, eh? Even my mother could do it. Well, okay, he's pissed off at this point, I can tell, you know. Oh, well, no, this is my recovery, I love this. Well, perhaps your mother's a very talented colorist. I don't know. But anyway, you know. But
weird, sensitive. They're sensitive. Comic book artists are all very sensitive.
Well, just, you know, interpersonal politics, it's so, you really have to just almost have a mask on and not say anything. Like, you understand where politicians get it from, you know. Because it really just takes business away at the drop of a hat. Mm-hmm. Because you don't know the football score, you are out of the loop. Mm-hmm. You know?
So what did you enjoy working on in DC Cartoons? Did you work on Dexter's Lab? Did you work on Powerpuff Girls? Did you work?
It would be a real mixed bag of what they would send me. But I always enjoy working on the kids' comics and trying to, like, what I like to do is do the work and add two colors onto everything, like Japanese animation. That's something I got from that. Their coloring is always so beautiful and so graphic, and so I try and ape that. And so it was interesting to get to work on these cartoon forms I was very familiar with, you know, Tasmanian Devil. Hey, mm-hmm. No problem. Daffy Duck. All right, I'll get to put two colors on that beak.
Like, now, did you do this on the computer?
No, at that point it was all just getting a Xerox of the story and using colored pencil to indicate any sort of fades or what color, and then labeling each thing with this long combination of like Y5, B2, R3, you know.
It sounds kind of complicated.
It really was, and always impossible to get all the lettering all the way around. I still have tons of work that I've done. I still have this stuff. It was so labor intensive, I'm hesitate to throw it away. I mean, I slave for hours on this stuff, you know, and yet it's not useful for anything. Maybe some sort of installation project or something, where I'll paper a wall with it.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about your coloring, because I find your coloring really innovative. One of my favorite things that you've done recently is the Tripping the Rift cartoons online, because it really shows through your coloring style.
That's right. Well, the Tripping the Rift, I got to do 100%. I got to write it and draw it and color it myself. And so when I get to do everything, I can really design the project so that I know I'm doing it in color. I'm just going to do contour line drawings now. My biggest complaint with working with other artists is that they don't seem to trust a colorist. They draw as if it's for black and white. Everything, all the shadows are locked down with all this cross-hatching and stuff, and it makes it very difficult to do the work. If they would just do outlines and trust me to add shadow, I would do a job that would please them very much, I'm sure. But I don't get that chance. And because everything's kind of drawn for black and white, it becomes just like a matter of putting flat colors behind everything. Otherwise, you're contradicting what they say. And it can be painful, you know. But what's funny is, even when I get to talk to the artist beforehand, and they say, well, do you have any requirements? Well, can you please do a contour line job? You know, it'll be faster. You won't spend any time. You know, you'll make more money. Well, sorry, man, I can't do that. I can't believe you could ask for that. You know, what?
Ah, the industry. It's great, because you don't really know this unless you're in it.
Mm. Well, it's like any business, I'm sure. I'm sure whether you're in car parts or, you know, lettering comic books, you've heard it all before.
Now, because you had so much freedom in Tripping the Riff, did you challenge yourself at all?
Well, sure, trying to stay with other people's characters. What I did was I tried to please myself. Tripping the Rift, if you watch the animated cartoons, they're incredibly violent, incredibly sexist, and kind of misogynist in it. It really...
I don't even like the style. It's that computer animation style that's a bit grotesque, and I'm not into it.
But it is irreverent in the same way that, you know, hearing somebody say poop or swear on TV or something is kind of gives you a giggle, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, they definitely push bad taste quite far, quite startlingly far sometimes. I mean, it's a show where you watch it and your eyebrows go up and they just stay there the whole show. You can't believe what they're doing, you know. They have.
I guess you had to watch lots for research, huh?
Yeah, I got 2 seasons on DVD, so there's like 15 hours of material, and I sat through it all, and I gotta say, I kind of became buddies with it after a while. Like, as flawed as it was, it still had its heart in the right place, I felt, you know. Mm-hmm. Not trying to be super commercial, which is something I don't like. I like irreverency.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what I'm trying to say? And I feel like it had a healthy kind of amount of disrespect for authority, which I fully agree with.
So how did you start? How did you tackle it?
I just wrote a story, first of all, which is unusual for me, because usually I like to sort of do things as I go along. But here I actually wrote an entire script, of course, which I deviated from incredibly. But still, it was a highly organized project in that I did the skeleton first.
My next question is about your baby, your darling, the thing that you've been working on forever to get her, is your graphic novel. Tell us about it. When did you start?
I started 5 years ago now, and 2004. Okay, in 2004 I got a grant. I applied for and received a grant from the Canada Council under the writers section, under established writers grants. There was an option to get a grant to write a graphic novel. And in all of the Canada Council service, that's the only place comic art was mentioned as a possibility. So I applied to write a graphic novel. And as an established writer, I applied for the full budget, which was $20,000. And I received it, much to my...
Congratulations!
Thank you. And, you know, of course, it was gone in 8 months. And I'm still working on the work that it started, and I'm honor-bound to finish it, I feel, before I apply for another grant. Still, I decided I was going to do a graphic novel, which was all the rage.
And you mentioned it was the characters from The Jam?
That's right. It's basically a sort of dystopian romantic comedy, an examination of relationship dynamics in the less than perfect world. And I decided to use my sort of male and female archetypes, which are Gordy and Janet, the boyfriend and girlfriend duo from The Jam, which is my superhero satire book, which never went anywhere compared to the Mutant Ninja Turtles. And that's something to think about. That can destroy a man.
Oh, I wouldn't worry too much about it. Kevin Eastman went and blew all his money in frivolous things.
Peter Laird, though, he opened up...
He was a lot smarter.
He did the Zarek Foundation, which still survives today and encourages poor schmoes like me. Mm-hmm. Like, I may well...
You could totally get a Zarek, you know, because what's her name?
I'm going to try.
Desert Peach. Oh, I've forgotten her name.
Donna Barr.
Yes.
Yeah, well, and they just probably 10 years ago, opened it up to Canadians as well.
Yes.
So, and that's, you really got to admire that. They really took their money, or Peter Laird, in his case, took his money that he made from comics and plowed it back into comics. Yeah. And that's something I admire and would love to have.
Well, you know, Kevin Eastman did the same thing. You can't deny it. I mean, he started his own publishing company and he gave money to a lot of people to make their own comics. And then after that, when that failed, he was doing heavy metal and he's giving lots of people chances to publish their stories.
Tundra reprinted the first 5 issues of The Jam in color. So I have them to thank for that, you know. Even though what I was hoping for was a collection. And I've yet to have a collection of anything of The Jam. And that's definitely life's... desire.
Do you think if they collected, or if you collected it, would you go and color the stuff that's all black and white? Because it's pretty mishmash, like it's black and white color, it's all over the place.
Well,
would you let it be like, would you do it chronologically? So, or would you be like, okay, here's the black and white stuff and here's the color stuff?
There is a chronology to observe. I would print the black and white, the color stuff in black and white. I'd probably make it a black and white collection because it's designed for black and white, you know? And I think it's not a, I mean, it might be a commercial barrier, but as an artist, black and white has always been like a whole genre unto itself, you know? And just the same way that I like film noir or whatever, I think that the work is more suited to black and white. I'd like to see it printed on nice paper so that the black is absolutely black.
Super that's, crisp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that's the key to black and white printing. And
oh, yeah. You don't want to go with the old 80s black and white boom newsprint.
Yeah, where it's all gray and it's like, oh, God.
So you've had some really interesting friends over time. The first time I ever heard or saw you was in a Joe Matt comic, and you're really close friends with Pat McEwen, who's also an excellent, excellent cartoonist. You were around when these guys were starting and getting their drawing chops.
Well, it's been really interesting. I knew Pat just by chance. I mean, we've been acquaintances over about a 20-year period. When Air Cell, which was a Canadian
company. Were you ever involved in that? Because I know Dave Cooper was heavily involved, and so was Pat and Barry Blair as well.
That's right. Barry Blair was the leader. He was the guy who worked at the company Air Cell Insulation that was run by this guy, Ken somebody, a short red-haired pirate of a man.
He was so like, did Ken realize he was also a comic publisher inadvertently?
Barry convinced Ken to be the investor into his comic thing. But excellent. Then Samurai, their comic, became a huge beeping hit. And it was like, no one could believe it. It was like, people bought out entire print runs. Scott Rosenberg, remember him?
No.
He's sort of a comic speculator from the 70s and 80s. He scandalized everybody by just swooping in and buying their entire second print run of Samurai number one, you know.
That is insane.
They were making serious
Nobody money. Would do that today. Nobody.
Well, they were one of the only people, aside from Dave Sim, who was publishing Cerebus at the time, who were really...
What was their second print run, like 50 issues?
I have no idea.
That's the silliest thing I've ever heard. Sorry.
Air Cell did quite well initially.
No, but just to buy the whole print run.
Yes. Well,
it's a measure of excess.
But Pat was one of their crew, and as far as I was concerned, he was one of the best artists there.
Mm-hmm.
So later on, when Matt Wagner came to Montreal and he was dating his wife-to-be Barbara, and we shared a studio, and he was talking about Grendel and saying he needed another artist, I said, what about Pat McEwen? So I'm happy that I was sort of the catalyst that kind of brought Pat into the whole Grendel machine, though I wonder if Pat's happy.
So I know Joe Matt also worked on Grendel, but is that how you got involved with Joe?
Joe Matt was good friends with Matt Wagner and would follow him around pretty much everywhere he went. And so Joe was doing, he was kind of like Matt's assistant and doing coloring chores and whatnot. And then he was also on the side doing his diary pages, which became Automat from Kitchen Sink, or Peep Show.
It was Peep Show, too.
Peep Show?
Yeah.
Okay, so it was a big oversized book with like the 40 panels per page.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually even jammed with him on some of those. We were roommates for about a year during that period. And he actually writes about it in Peep Show. And I love it. Even though he criticizes me and he draws me like, you know, not like I look.
Yeah, he draws you like a chubby and then you're like a mooch, a super mooch all the time.
Yeah, yeah, you know.
And you're totally, totally frivolous. But I really like that because I'm the same way. I was like, yeah, I've got money now. Let's go have fun. Like,
yeah, no, he's very, very, he sort of floats above the crowd and looks down upon us all, you know. But still, I love being in a comic strip. As a cartoonist, there is no greater honor than to be a character in somebody else's thing, even if they're making fun of you. So I enjoy that.
So I totally got sidetracked. I wanted to ask you, when do you think To Get Her will be done?
I In about a year or so, I have about 80 pages left. I've done about 115 so far. I generally have to fit it in between rent-paying jobs. I got like two part-time jobs at a bookstore and one helping home care this young boy. And, you know, these things take up about 5 days of my week. And so it seems like I'm always like, you know, go to sleep, wake up, okay, gotta go to work, gotta eat supper now, throw supper down. You know, I feel like I'm in the army or something, always trying to...
An automaton.
Yeah, meet a schedule. But I'm trying to be more disciplined and get the work in. If I do a page a week, that's good. But now that I do all my work on the computer, I find that I tend to put more detail in it. But it feels good. This is a graphic. I wouldn't call it a novel. It seems like, all told, it'll probably take about an hour to read through. And it's more like a graphic week, you know?
a graphic moment,
you know? A graphic tidbit. So it doesn't seem like it's possible 5 years of my life is distilled into this work. And I wonder how many more of those I have in me. Not too
now,
many.
Now, did you start it doing to get her on the computer? Or did you... change over halfway through?
No, it's designed as a computer-oriented project. I do all my contour line drawings with Flash, Macromedia's Flash or Adobe's
Flash. Is that common?
Flash.
I don't really know much about computer artwork.
Well, it's common. It's a simple vector-based program. Vector files are really interesting in that they're very small and they're infinitely rescalable, so you can totally take bits and pieces from a background and kind of blow them up and stretch them and use them again and flop them. I find it very handy. And also it has a smooth option where you can take your drawing and sort of, it makes the lines a little bit more curved. So in a way you kind of get a more fluid cartoony line. It's a bit like cheating, but I love its effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I rely on that quite a bit. And then when I get my black contour line image, I'll bring it into Photoshop and use that for gray as her color.
So this, to get her, is it in color or is it in black
It's
and
a
white?
8.5 by 11 inch black and white project. There are text portions. The first 9 pages are prose, but it's designed as a large print kind of project because I believe that... lettering is far too tiny these days. My vision is not that great. I want to cut people a break when it comes to reading a lot of words. So throughout the book there are kind of prose sections. I think of them as word balloons, or thought balloons rather. And that's part of the experiment of what I'm doing is interspersing images with words more thoroughly. And I look forward to finishing it up, though, after 4 or 5 years of looking at the same job. It's like a marriage, you know. You really, it's, your relationship to the work is not fresh anymore, and it really takes a lot of motivation to get through it. I look forward to doing smaller projects afterwards.
Yeah, with my writing, I don't think I've ever really loitered over any of it. I just get it out, get it done.
What's the longest thing you've ever written?
Not very long.
How many thousand words?
I don't count them, and honestly, I haven't written very long stuff, though.
You know, they say a novel is 125,000 words.
I've never written, I have. In junior high, I wrote a really bad novel, but that's junior high. Anyways.
Well, I hope you still have it.
Yes, I do.
There you go.
I was also going to ask you about your new stuff, because you mentioned earlier that you were doing some historical stuff as of late.
Well, I got involved with a children's book publisher, and they were doing a series on Canadian prime ministers, sort of these short bio pieces, and I got involved with two of their books in that series, and then went from there to a book on the history of native land claims here in Canada, and I had hopes of designing that whole book from head to toe, but in the end had the job yanked away from me, and they totally cut it apart and got somebody else to... It was a large type project, but they totally reduced the type and the amount of pages, so the order of my illustrations was arbitrarily changed, and I can't even show it to anybody now, you know. So
that's disappointing.
Yeah.
It's
and
something you probably could have been really proud of.
Exactly. I wanted to design the book from head to toe, but had that yanked away from me.
And that's all you've been working on lately?
That took up the last year and a half. I did the Tripping the Riff strip. That took about a year and a bit. And that was quite intense. I did 52 strips.
It looks
strips.
It. It looks really good.
No, thanks. I'm very proud of it. And I got to write the thing from beginning to end. So I like to think that I gave the female character a better part, made her smarter. You know, the original series, if you watch it, it's just startlingly all the worst about
How did that happen, actually? Because that's Chuck Austin, right, that was working on that?
He originally... it was him and Steve Moeller. Moeller? M-O-E-L-L-E-R.
It's not Steve, though. I want to say Chris. But...
Chris.
Yeah.
Yes, Chris.
He's Moeller. A good artist, too, actually. Yeah. I quite like his stuff.
That's right. He's got a great sci-fi style. They apparently got together with some Korean animation house and produced a Tripping the Rift pilot that's about 2 minutes in length. Very sexy, very violent. And pushing that whole sexy violent thing. And then Cinegroup, a Canadian company, made by a lot of people who came up through heavy metal and stuff. These are all people that got work through heavy metal that stayed in the animation industry. And an effects animator from heavy metal is now a producer at Cinegroup. And a background layout artist who was in heavy metal is now the producer or the director of Tripping the Rift, the TV show. And it's a perfect reflection of his dark, twisted sense of humor, you know. It's certainly true to the director. The director's vision is coming through unimpeded, I'd say.
So did they remember you from when you were toiling away from the cartoon?
Yes, I've known them all the way along, and I think it's a bone that they threw my way out of the kindness of their hearts. And hopefully I didn't make them sorry.
No, I don't think so. I love that.
Yeah, well, it's supposed to be viewed on a Tripping the Rift specific website, but the website is sort of hanging there in cyberspace, unmanned, and the strip is yet to... They just got 15...
So, here I am talking about this work, and nobody's going to be able to see it.
Yes, well,
that's
they can
horrifying.
They can see it if they just write me and ask me, can I see it? And I'm a easy touch, you know.
It's definitely worth seeing. I quite like it. So who are some of your influences, would you say?
Oh, boy. I loved the whole EC crew and Wally Wood.
You were talking about Harvey Kurtzman earlier?
Yeah, the early Mad magazine. Not the magazine, but the comic book form. I always thought that was just amazing. And that whole crew that worked on there, Will Elder, Harvey Kurtzman, John Severin.
Marie. Severin.
Yeah, Marie Severin, too. John Severin's sister.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just got a romance comic from Studio 9, and it had a Hey Look reprint in the back.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh.
There, by Mr. Kurtzman.
Yeah, and wild, cartoony style. I really like when he does more dramatic stuff. Mm-hmm. His war comics.
Stuff is amazing.
Yeah, I find the combination of his... Well, his storytelling is really deeply influential on mine because... He does the six-panel grid quite frequently. You notice his layouts. Quite often he'll have a big splash panel or an extra-large panel, but then he'll generally drop into six squares on a page.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about that a lot and agree with that in that it's the best compromise between size and enough panels on a page. You want to deliver some sort of value, some sort of
bang
scene,
for your buck.
You know, you don't want to just have one illustration mm-hmm. per page. But when it gets much smaller, it tends to, unless your cartooning is very, very simple, it gets very difficult to see. And I think, once again, it's all about vision.
Mm-hmm.
Because my vision is kind of not perfect. I need the stuff to be designed so that it's easy to read and have some sort of clarity. So I like the six-panel grid and use it all the time myself.
Mm-hmm.
Unless I have a specific idea for a layout, I'm not going to deviate from... the sacred foam.
Do you have any influences with your color work?
Yes, Japanese animation, all there. Just the way that they will use in color a sort of demarcation of shadow. I think that was always really effective and a lot of fun to do.
Have you ever seen Serial Experiments Lane?
Yes, a couple of episodes.
I just found the coloring in that to be really interesting, and it had a bit of a wash, and to me it was innovative for what I'd seen of the anime so far.
You ever seen My Neighbor's Yamadas?
No.
Oh, charming. It's like the Asian equivalent of a Charlie Brown Christmas or something. You know, it's just about Japanese family conundrums and foibles and all the problems they have, but then they all get together at the end of the movie and, hey, Merry Christmas, or whatever they do in Japan. And but the American voices are James Belushi, and but it really works. It's really charming and very, very beautiful. I heartily recommend it as being like one of the most pure and sincere moving things. And it's Asian animation. They really took the animation ball and ran with it. I gotta say, Japan and Asia in general, their video games, their comics, their movies, I love it all.
Yeah, what I love, I was telling some parents yesterday about Miyazaki, and you think about the animation in Spirited Away, like she's wandering through a forest and you see like the light prickling on her face as the sun comes through the trees. Like, it's just beautiful, beautiful work.
They got a whole different department for like light reflecting off face, you know, like, and they all wear face masks and like work in rows.
Meticulously, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing to think that even the most famous director in Japan still makes less than a middle-ranked civil servant here in North America.
How's that now?
Well, that perhaps doesn't include Mr. Miyazaki, but in general, wages are much lower in Japan, like currently. Like a doctor in an emergency room is making $5 an hour.
That's crazy.
That's what I'd heard.
And how's the cost of living?
I suppose it varies wildly between whether
you shop in... city or country. Interesting. Well, I never lived there, so I don't know. One of the last couple of things I wanted to ask you about was, I find in a lot of your cartoons, or comics rather, you have a really feminist bent when it comes to your females, which is sort of rare amongst your generation of cartoonists.
I was always an ardent feminist. Now the position has gotten much, much softer, because after being in a series of relationships and realizing that it's not so much about oppression as it is about political maneuvering and how it's all a blend of... I mean, yeah, there are places where there are blatant injustices, like equal pay for equal work, I think, is an obvious one. What? Mm-hmm. That's not universal? Oh my God, how embarrassing. They're not even embarrassed, you know? Like, Jesus, you'd think it's something like that, you just put sunlight on it and it would, like, a vampire shrivel up, you know? But no, people are actually still running stuff like this. That's embarrassing. It's embarrassing to be a guy and not to be able to sort of go, well, I'm an honorable creature. You know, the whole history of the relationship between the sexes is embarrassing. And it's always makes me very angry to hear or see somebody acting poorly, because it reflects on all of us. And I really wish that... there was some sort of example, some sort of role model that everybody could agree with, like that would pop up in the media, that would all of a sudden make everybody drone like, go, okay, now we shall be fair and kind, and, you know, because that's what the only thing that seems to turn people.
We just got to get those Jonas Brothers or somebody to promote it.
Jonas Brothers?
Yeah, they're like these three brothers who are teen heartthrob musicians.
Ah.
All the preteens love them.
Well, there you go. You know, if the Jonas Brothers say this is the way to be,
then that's the way to be.
That's the way to be. Tiger Beat.
Okay, my last question. Let's talk about your music, because you've been in quite a few bands, too.
Yeah, I love music. It's a wonderful thing. I think everybody should do it, regardless of whether or not somebody else tells you you're good. You know, it's just good for you.
What do you play?
I play guitar. I play whatever I can, you know, like sometimes a little keyboard or whatever's around that you might use to write a song with. You can generally make it do very simple things and build some sort of composition around that. So I like to try whatever I can get my hands on, but in generally, a guitar. And I have a band that I play with, which I'm very honored to get to play with them. They're actually the main core of a local band here in Montreal called Nutsack. Generally, it features Sam Shalabi on lead guitar, Chris Burns on secondary guitar, not secondary really, but, you know, for for the sake of this description. Andre Asley on bass and Howard Chakowitz, a fellow cartoonist, plays the drums. These guys are great, and they do sort of a jazz rock fusion thing and funk very easily. But I get to play with the whole band minus Sam Shalabi when I play with my band Bug Eyed Monster, and they bring such a wealth of flavor to the material. My material is very simple, but after they get through with it, it's a bossa nova. It's a world beat fusion, you know,
extravaganza.
They really just add so much that I feel like I can legitimately present it to people in a live setting and be proud of it.
When have you performed? Where?
There's the Casa del Popolo, a local club that's within walking distance of where I live, and that's where a lot of Nutsack's play dates are, as well as the American Devices, who is another band that my drummer and bass player formed the rhythm section of. That's another well-known Montreal band. So, you know, it's just wonderful to play with these guys. They're so used to it. They're such strong improvisational players that even if they don't remember my material, because we practice fairly infrequently, still, within 2 minutes, they're right there behind me, and it's like doing it. It's like as if we've been practicing for months, you know. It's a real pleasure to play with them. They're also gentlemen.
So do you, like, do events? Have you guys played Exposine or...?
No, we don't.
Vernissages?
I've yet to be more aggressive in that area. What I'd like to do is just get a recording so that I can show people as a sample. I also have video ambitions where I could mix live performance with animation. I like doing animation using Flash. Those are all my ambitions for the future. But right now, of course, it's a challenge just to get supper on the table and run all the various subroutines that a home with a partner and two kids require.
Have you done animation that we can see?
Yeah, a lot of my stuff is kind of halfway done. I did some animation for Heavy.com a couple of years ago. Two short films for them. But actually, they're fairly big. One's 6 minutes long. Sort of behind the music that sucks. Their satire version of behind the music. And one dealing with Cher. And another episode dealing with the Dixie Chicks. So, you know, that was quite a bit of filmmaking done in 1 month. I'm amazed at what I can do when faced with a deadline and a paycheck.
That's all you need is a little bit of money.
Yeah. I have other projects that I've done just on my own. One is like the sort of film version of the strip Isaac versus Eli, which features my sons as two combating superheroes. And
which is very true to life.
Yes, well, definitely the combat, you know, trying to make lemonade out of those lemons.
Called children.
Yes. But Eli's 17 now and Isaac is 20, or Eli will be 17 and Isaac will be 21 as of the end of this February. So I look forward to a time when they throw off matriarchal and patriarchal oppression and go off on their own, and we mourn their loss forever trying to pick up the pieces of our lives.
Without them. you have a website. You want to plug it?
No, because it's got the wrong email address on it, and I want to take it down and strip it down and just make like a page, but bless you for asking, dear.
Okay.
And I think the internet is a great place to put up those things they call websites. Mm-hmm. And people do a search for your name, and your website pops up, and you can tell them and let them know anything you want. So that's a great idea.
All right.
I'm going to do that.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Robin.
Thank you for your time, Bernie.